Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who and what have made Mexico the country it is today, and how can we expect the past and present to shape the future of this vibrant but often troubled society? Having studied the country since 1966, my guest today is uniquely qualified to recognize watershed developments in Mexico's modern history and to anticipate the questions raised by media coverage of its day-to-day issues. Roderick A.I. Camp is Philip M. McKenna Professor of the Pacific Rim at Claremont McKenna College, and he serves on the advisory board of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars in the Smithsonian Institution. His new book is called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know. Roderick, welcome to Think.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. So I realize that this book is part of a series by Oxford University Press that will eventually cover a number of different countries, but I'm wondering if you think that Mexico in some ways is particularly misunderstood, especially given that it is so close to this country.
Yes, I think that's probably true because obviously the challenges that Mexico faces and the media coverage of some of those challenges tends to highlight certain aspects, and I would even venture to say the more negative aspects of those conditions, and therefore I think many people don't have a balanced view or a very complete view of really what's either involved in Mexico or the relationship between Mexico and the United States.
Yeah, and as much as these things concern many Americans, it turns out Mexicans themselves are far more concerned with economic issues than with either drug crime or government corruption, which is often the first place Americans go.
Yes, that's true, and I think what's been interesting about that has been the case for really the last three presidential elections since 1994, and surveys demonstrate that in the last 10 years, those economic issues combined, which deal with economic development, unemployment, and poverty, outstrip, you know, any other issue. If you look at just a single issue, such as employment versus personal security, in certain years, including this past year, security becomes more important. But if you combine all of the economic issues together, they generally account for 40 to 50% of what Mexicans consider to be the most important issues for their country to resolve.
That said, because this book, I presume, is for a largely American audience, you open the book with a question that is on the minds of Americans, which is why there's so much drug violence in Mexico today. And I guess the answer is we need to look in the mirror to answer that question.
Yes, that's definitely the case. Obviously, the most important cause of drug trafficking and therefore drug violence in Mexico is the U.S. demand. About 9% of all Americans over the age of 12 consume some type of illegal drug, most of which actually is transported through Mexico or from Mexico. And therefore, that demand, which is very little in the last decade, is what really is the engine of growth for this problem in Mexico. Now, there are other issues in Mexico which have contributed to the level of violence, including perhaps the most important one is the emphasis of the Calderón administration since 2006 to confront drug trafficking organizations in Mexico in a much more proactive way. And as you know, they've essentially relied very heavily on the armed forces as well as federal police to do that. And having had some success in catching and killing drug traffickers, particularly some important leaders, they've temporarily created what I would call a economic vacuum in the drug trafficking territories of the respective drug cartels. And therefore, those cartels have intensified their efforts not only against government forces, but against each other to try to capture those very lucrative routes for transporting drugs across Mexico and into the United States.
What sort of impediment did the cartels present in terms of interfering with the sovereign operations of local and state and federal government in Mexico?
Yes, that's a very significant issue, Chris. And I think the most important element of that is the threats by criminals who are associated with the drug cartels against not only local officials, particularly mayors and the members of the executive agencies in various states as well, are subject to threats. Their families are subject to threats. The drug cartels obviously use bribery as a very significant technique to get people to do what they want them to do. And because Mexico has a justice system which is in the process of being reformed but is not very effective at dealing with prosecuting drug cartels. For example, they don't essentially have a witness protection program, which we do in the United States, and therefore it's very difficult to convict such individuals. So in the broadest sense, political corruption and economic corruption become a very serious issue. If you can't protect the individual holding in the position of authority in law enforcement or a prosecuting attorney or even a businessman who is subject to intimidation and bribery the way you would encounter in certain parts of the United States where the U.S. mafia has been influential, then it's very difficult to eliminate those threats and thereby create more sovereign control by authorities in certain parts of Mexico.
You do take pains, in fact, to remind us and make us aware of the fact that the degree of violence and lack of control by local governments varies greatly depending on where you happen to travel within Mexico.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's another one of those issues that is not clearly communicated by the media, including the Mexican media, to Mexicans and Americans both. In fact, the government, after much pressure in the last few years, has finally published some very significant statistics which demonstrate that of the approximately 2,400 plus what we would call counties in the United States, only 6% of those are responsible for more than 80% of those violent deaths and conflicts. And therefore, it depends very much on where you are in Mexico or where you are going or from, you know, what point A to point B you are traveling that you would actually encounter the level of violence that has created this problem of personal security in Mexico.
And not surprisingly, all of this drug crime south of the border does have an impact on life just north of the border, but not necessarily in the ways that people might imagine who don't live in those communities.
Yes, that's true. I think it's not, it's becoming, I think, more significant than it's been in the past, but it all depends on the linkages between drug cartels, which are obviously active in Mexico, and not just in the northern border states, but elsewhere in Mexico, and their links to individuals and groups in the United States, often young members of criminal urban gangs in the United States, and in Canada, I might add, who are linked to both transporting and distributing drugs elsewhere in the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Roderick A.I. Camp, whose new book is called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know. You open chapter two, Roderick, with a question well worth discussing this hour, which is how poor is Mexico? What do we need to look at in order to answer that question?
Well, I think Americans need to understand that Mexico is what we would describe as a developing economy. It has been attempting to address poverty for many years, and is particularly seriously, I think, since the late 1980s. And it has developed a number of anti-poverty programs, which actually under Presidents Zedillo and Fox had considerable success. The way to understand this, I think, clearly for Americans is that throughout the 80s and 90s and into the early part of this century, approximately half of all Mexicans were living in poverty, defined by the United Nations as earning $2 or less per capita per day. About half of those individuals were living in a condition of extreme poverty, which is only $1 or less per capita per day. The Mexican government, through its anti-poverty programs, was able, under Fox and into the early part of the Calderón administration, to probably reduce that to somewhere close to 43% of the population. But it has risen back up because of the recession in the United States, which has affected Mexico greatly, and it's probably somewhere between 45 and 47% of the population.
So among the most effective elements of those anti-poverty initiatives in Mexico have been social welfare programs and also education. How good is that compulsory public education in Mexico today?
Well, it's a complaint that a lot of critics have raised, particularly in rural areas, and that has been Mexico recognizing that, in particular, the importance of elementary education and particularly secondary education, which we know from other countries in Asia, for example, have produced significant positive consequences on the pace of economic development in those countries, that it's important to link the two. So one of the programs that Mexico has used and advocated, in fact, the World Bank has even praised them and emulated this program elsewhere, is called Opportunities, Oportunidades, which is basically saying we'll give you some assistance if you meet a certain poverty level, if you show proof that your children are attending school. So you don't get the subsidy unless the children are in school. Of course, the second issue is the quality of the education itself, and that's a different issue that Mexico also needs to address.
And so those subsidies that go to families essentially are a disincentive to sending kids to work when they're, say, 14 or 15.
Yeah, but even younger, really disincentives to what it's really been in most cases, as you will find elsewhere in the third world, is children in rural areas, but even in urban areas, working either on the farm, their parents' farm, or in a family business, even when they would be elementary school-age children. So what this does is allow the person to make up the difference of what that child's labor would contribute to the welfare of the family and allow the young person to go to school.
Roderick A.I. Camp is my guest. He serves on the advisory board of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. His new book is called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Roderick A.I. Camp. He's Philip M. McKenna Professor of the Pacific Rim at Claremont McKenna College, and he serves on the advisory board of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Affairs in the Smithsonian Institution. His new book is called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know. Roderick, since we were talking about education, I wanted to address this. In Mexico, for a very long time, education was largely the purview of the Catholic Church. Today, that is no longer the case. Can you talk about how and why the official power of the Church has changed over the past century?
Yes, well, it goes back actually to the mid-19th century when the Catholic Church became allied essentially with conservative forces in Mexico, not to be confused with conservative in the United States. But anyway, to make a long story short, there was essentially a very bloody conflict and a civil war between liberals and conservatives who had different views as to how to solve Mexico's economic and social problems. And the conservatives allied themselves with the Catholic hierarchy, but the liberals eventually won that battle, and the conservatives had allied themselves with the French, who had intervened in Mexico in the 1860s when we were occupied with our own civil war. And of course, by defeating the French and the conservatives, that gave the liberals the ability to reduce the influence of the Catholic Church. And one of the areas that the liberals thought was essential to decreasing the church's long-term influence was to take away their control over education, which they did by inserting it in the Constitution of 1857. What's interesting is that in the Mexican Revolution of 1910 and its current Constitution of 1917, once again, those restrictions were included. And it meant really two things. One is that the church was very much restricted from influencing elementary education. And secondly, the federal government, in effect, took over the control of the curriculum of grades 1 through 6, so that basically everyone who went to public school was using the same textbooks for those 6 grades.
Yeah, what's so interesting about that road to separation of church and state is that it's not really cultural. It's still an overwhelmingly Catholic country, but it's a political issue.
Yes, that's true. And it's become more moderated as the, essentially one could argue, the government needed other venues for education, particularly secondary and preparatory education and higher education. So the Catholic Church has been an important contributor, particularly in the last 30 or 40 years, to increasing the quality of education through what we would call private education. And some of the leading universities were universities that were started and continue to be influenced by a Catholic religious order, such as the Jesuits. The Ibero-American University in Mexico City, which President Fox graduated from, is an example of one of those institutions.
You write here, Roderick, that social expenditures by the Mexican government rose by 75% between 1996 and 2008. Where is the money coming to pay for those?
Well, it's coming from typical revenues, but one of the major sources of revenues for all federal expenditures in Mexico is actually through the sale and export of petroleum crude that can be converted into gasoline, and that's always been an important resource in Mexico. Unfortunately, the Mexican government has used those resources as they receive them rather than creating reserves of funds which come directly from the earnings that are attributed to the export of oil. And consequently, as those reserves decline and the government has not been able to, the political parties have not been able to agree on opening up the exploitation of what new reserves they have to outside technical and economic investment. It has restricted the amount of monies that are available to address those types of issues, you know, whether it's dealing with education or dealing with poverty or dealing with other social and economic issues the government would like to expend more funds on.
You mentioned that some of this money comes from petroleum resources. Talk a little bit about the history of the nationalization of the petroleum industry and other natural resources within Mexico.
Well, that goes back to the early part of the 20th century and even earlier under Porfirio Diaz, who was a authoritarian president of Mexico, essentially from the late 1870s up through 1910 at the point of the Mexican Revolution. And he permitted a great deal of foreign investment in Mexico in major areas such as utilities, transportation, the railroad system was largely foreign controlled, and in the exploitation of underground minerals, silver and oil, and so on. So when the Constitution of 1917 was generated by people who were elected from all sort of like congressional districts in Mexico, one of the most important issue, which was prompted by an anti-foreign element as part of the Mexican Revolution, was to make those underground subsoil resources, the ownership of those resources would lie in the hands of the Mexican people and therefore the state. And that's how Mexico got into the situation where all of these resources were to be controlled and developed by the state. It became such a strong part of the rhetoric of the Mexican Revolution of 1910 that this is what makes it very difficult for members of Congress to go out and campaign and convince both their colleagues as well as the voters that Mexico should modernize its attitudes towards the control and exploitation of these resources so that they can develop them more efficiently. And that hasn't been possible even in the last two administrations.
So Mexicans were able to vote for a very long time before the country could be reasonably called a democracy. Can you talk a little bit about the transition and when it could finally be described as having taken hold?
The transition, I think, most importantly, begins in the early 1980s, although there were electoral reforms that were critical in the 1960s and then again in the 1970s, which made possible the expansion of electoral competition and strengthening the other parties other than the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, which so dominated Mexico from 1929 to 2000. The first election where essentially the electoral process could be described as largely free and fair was the election of 1994, in which President Zedillo was the victor, and that was won by the PRI, but it is significant because it demonstrated that the opposition parties, which are the two major ones, the two major parties at that time were the National Action Party, which had been around since 1939, and the more recent Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD, which nearly won the last presidential election from the National Action Party. Those parties then were confident that in the election of 2000 that they could compete, and if they happened to have chosen a very effective candidate, they might actually win the election. And what happened in 2000 is that the National Action Party candidate, Mr. Fox, and the pre-candidate were actually neck and neck when the election campaign closed a few days before the election was held. So all of the media polls demonstrated that they were very close to each other, and you know, it was impossible to predict who would win. And in that case, Mr. Fox, in the remaining few days when there were no polls, seemed to have gathered up a large percentage of independent voters who cast their ballot for him, and he came away with more than two-fifths of the vote in Mexico. And that was the first defeat of the PRI for a presidential race since it had dominated Mexican politics in the 1920s.
You mentioned the National Action Party, which many people realize is nicknamed the PAN Party. Is there a clear line between the goals and aspirations of, say, the PRI Party and the PAN Party? And what does each side stand for?
Well, it used to be that the PAN Party was always described as the right of center, and some people actually described it as the party of the right in Mexico, in contrast to the PRI, which was viewed as a statist party, viewed itself as the heritage of the Mexican revolutionary principles. And basically, you could distinguish them between the PRI wanting to use government to accomplish more social and economic goals for Mexico, and the PAN wanting to use a philosophy of strengthening the private sector to increase the pace of economic development in Mexico. But by the 1990s, after President Salinas had come into office, the whole impact of economic neoliberalism, which was taking place elsewhere in the world, but particularly in Latin America, had begun to take hold in Mexico. So in a way, from an economic angle, the two parties were converging as far as how they would solve those issues. But the PRI itself, the leadership of the PRI, was divided between politicians who wanted to go back to a stronger state role and those politicians who would actually pursue a strategy more similar to that which PAN itself has followed in the last two administrations. And so if you're looking at them today, one of the ways that would distinguish them, I think, is for the leadership of the PRI wanting to strengthen some of those state strategies. But the differences between the two as far as the economic approach that both are using is not that significant. I think what may become significant, but we don't know exactly how the new presidential candidates from those parties will position themselves, is what is their solution to Mexico's security problem. That may well be the most significant issue which will push voters in one direction or the other.
Lots of Americans who believe that NAFTA has not been good for the U.S. assume it must instead have chiefly benefited Mexico, but it certainly hasn't produced the kind of economic growth within Mexico that many people hoped for.
Well, what has happened, and it's always been, this has been strongly debated, it is if you look at now, after 15 years or so, we can look at the statistics. And what the statistics demonstrate pretty clearly is that NAFTA did benefit, actually, both countries. And I want to point this out because most Americans don't realize that Mexico is a huge consumer of our exports. In fact, Mexico buys more exports than China. That gives you some idea of why it's so significant in our economic development, because it probably is responsible for, I would say, 750,000 jobs in the U.S. in those purchases. But NAFTA specifically increased the size of the Mexican economy and even the growth of the Mexican economy, but what it didn't do was increase the ability of Mexico to distribute that wealth more evenly. So Mexico, the distribution of wealth in Mexico has, except for very recently, in the last couple of years, has continued to remain unequal or more unequal than in the past. I might say that this is true in the U.S. as well. So the as well as the fact that whereas the U.S. had a program in place to retrain workers who lost their jobs because of the reduction of tariffs and the increased trade, in Mexico that there were no monies for that. So many people lost work. That not only increased the poverty of those individuals in Mexico, but as you might guess, many of them came to the United States seeking jobs in the U.S. when our economy was booming.
It is interesting that, the U.S. and Mexico have pretty equivalent Gini scores, which measure overall economic inequality.
Yes. That's absolutely true, and I don't think most, if you ask most people, they couldn't imagine that the U.S. was as unequal in its distribution of income as Mexico, but it's true.
The difference, of course, is that the poorest Americans are not making $1 or $2 a day. They have more income than that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
My guest this hour is Roderick A.I. Camp. He's Philip M. McKenna Professor of the Pacific Rim at Claremont McKenna College. He also serves on the advisory board of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars in the Smithsonian Institution. We're talking this hour about his new book. It's called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Roderick A.I. Camp, who serves on the advisory board of the Mexican Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. His new book is called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know. I'm curious, Roderick, about this. You write about the fact that for now, the Mexican population remains skewed toward youth, but this is expected to change drastically by mid-century so that in 2050, there will be an equal number of Mexican citizens under age 20 and over age 65.
Yes, that's correct. And the implication of that, of course, is that as though those two populations increase or become proportionally larger amount of your total population, it essentially means that you have a much larger dependent population that needs to be supported by the working population, which is generally between the ages of 17 and 65.
And so is the country actively preparing for this, or is it something that they're sort of putting off?
Well, basically they're putting it off because this is going to be a very expensive element of how, again, another demand on the federal budget as to how Mexico is going to reallocate those resources. And naturally, the most important way to address that is not only in terms of planning how government retirement and health programs are going to be funded, but equally important, in fact, more important, is increasing the growth of the economy and having an economy which can both employ younger people coming into the workforce as well as older people who may want to stay in or have to stay in the workforce, as is true in among many older Americans who want to work beyond 65, and I think that's what you're going to see becoming the actual reality of that situation.
There is also a rapidly growing percentage of Mexican women in the Mexican workforce, which I think defies conventional wisdom of this sort of paternalistic society. That is not the case today.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think it also is another element that made predictions more difficult, demographic predictions, in terms of how Mexico, for example, could create enough employment to not only absorb 17-year-old males coming into the economy in the 90s and in the 2000s, but also females. And I think what is really interesting about changing attitudes in Mexico, I think a lot of people think Mexican attitudes reflect this macho view that was very popular in the 70s and 80s. And 90s, is that surveys demonstrate very clearly that now, pretty much almost even, Mexicans view women equal to men as deserving a job in their economy. And that was not the case, 20 or 30 years ago. And complementarily to that as well is the fact that also men now view, and this is very critical to women going into the economy and being productive members of the economy, getting an education is just as important for females as it is for males. And that's a significant change.
Since you brought up national surveys, I think it's a perfect time to touch on this fascinating CEDAC-Zogby poll that you include in Table 2 in the book.
Yeah.
How Mexicans and Americans view each other, and this is as of 2006, but I think Americans might be surprised to learn that 85% of us have favorable impressions of Mexicans, 35% of Mexicans have favorable impressions of Americans.
Yeah, I think a lot, several of those are reversed, I would say, in terms of what you intuitively might believe. And for example, one of the ones I thought was really interesting, there was another one about, they asked the question, would you want your child, or would you approve of your child marrying an American or Mexican?
Mm-hmm.
And the American response was overwhelmingly yes. I think it was about four-fifths of the respondents, whereas the Mexican response was only about half.
Hmm.
And I think most people would have probably reversed those two figures, just similar to the figure that you cited. There are a lot of, culturally, I think there are a lot of differences that would surprise people if they looked at those figures.
One thing we share in common is only 27% of Americans like the Mexican government and only 27% of Mexicans like the U.S. government.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting one as well. It's truly fascinating, and I think actually one of the ones I thought was really hard to believe was they were asking about, Americans. They asked two questions. Were Mexicans very hardworking, and were Americans very hardworking? And when Mexicans and Americans were asked about Mexicans, about half of both groups said, yes, Mexicans are very hardworking. But when they were asked about Americans, only 11% of Mexicans thought Americans were very hardworking. Maybe that's not surprising, but only 21% of Americans thought they were very hardworking, which I thought was an interesting level of response. It's very surprising.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Gabriel in Plano now. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I love your program.
Thank you.
I listen as much as I can. I would like to ask your guest, it's very interesting all what he's talking. What creates this abysmal difference in the income or in the level of wealth in between the population? I'm Mexican, I work in Mexico, and I have worked here. And over there, as a manager, I earn up to 20 times a minimum wage. here, that's impossible. The 20 times minimum wage will be a fortune over here. Mm-hmm. I would like, if your guests can talk a little bit, what creates this big difference? Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Roderick?
Well, it's a very complex question, but I think, you know, the real difference, and you use an excellent example, in my opinion, is that the economy has, with very few exceptions, never grown rapidly enough to absorb the population and then to reach what I would call a scarcity of labor, so that then the value of labor starts to increase, where it decreases the disparity between what you describe as a minimum wage, or let's say a wage for an unskilled person. The disparity between wages for unskilled and skilled people is much smaller in the U.S., not even if you got, you know, not including the management level. In Mexico, it's a much greater difference, and that's because essentially in probably your lifetime and my lifetime, there has rarely been a scarcity in labor. The other element that we were talking about earlier in the program is the educational difference, and of course it was much more exaggerated 20 or 30 years ago, but where other countries, Taiwan would be a good example. There have been some interesting comparisons between Taiwan and Mexico. And one of the major differences between those two economies since the 1950s, when the comparison was begun, is that Mexico put more of its resources into higher education, but put a far smaller proportion of resources, comparatively speaking, to Taiwan in primary and secondary education, and particularly vocational secondary education, developing applied skills that you could use in the workforce and in developing your economic skills and growth. And I think those are just two of the elements that I think help to explain that difference.
So in other words, if you don't invest in preparing these students to do very well in upper levels of education, it's almost a useless endeavor to create these better universities.
Yes, exactly. If you have too many college graduates but not enough people at the skilled level in the workforce, you can't expand your workforce. You notice how states in the United States trying to get investment from American companies are always trying to promote their educational system, because that means you've got a pool of labor. If you have a high percentage of students who graduate from high school, and the quality, going back to your point earlier, Chris, is good, you can attract investment. If you can attract investment, you can, you know, improve the breadth and growth of your economy. And the other thing that's happened as well in relation to your question is that other countries are competing more effectively for that investment, the most notable of which is China. China has been able to take away a lot of the investment that Mexico was receiving before 2000.
Hmm. In terms of how the U.S. might best assist Mexico moving forward, you think addressing its poverty problems would likely be the best approach. How do you think we would do this most effectively?
I think we have hardly ever given any assistance that would be considered economic assistance. And I think it's a mistake. You know, we spend more money on trying to help with the drug war than we've ever spent on finding out what promotes the drug war in Mexico. And one of the issues is the level of poverty, because that's where drug cartels can get employees. I mean, they've even advertised for people openly to join them rather than be unemployed. And the U.S. has never considered this seriously. And what I think would be the most important way we could contribute to that is to support the kind of anti-poverty programs, the effective anti-poverty programs that Mexico has actually introduced, particularly the ones that tie assistance to keeping your children in school, which addresses the problem that the issue that your caller just was asking about. So it would be an effective way to increase the skill level of that population and thereby being able to employ the best and most innovative Mexicans rather than having those Mexicans try to seek employment in the United States when the U.S. economy is improving or growing at a pace that it can absorb that labor. And it's so it not only benefits Mexico, but in the long run it benefits us. It has a dual impact. And it will actually would have a long-term impact, I think, on drug trafficking as well as reducing the potential for corruption. Corruption generally thrives on economies where poverty levels are high.
Tell us why, Roderick, you think Mexican immigration to the U.S. is so particularly contentious right now. And people talk about the immigration issue, but they're essentially talking about immigration from Mexico, whether legal or illegal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it really becomes important, and you sort of notice these upticks in either two situations. One, it can become a political issue in U.S. presidential campaigns or state congressional campaigns. And secondly, it becomes an issue in particular, in general terms, when the economy is not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, and all demographers who study immigration seriously know, that basically people are seeking work. So people who are leaving countries to try to improve their lot somewhere else are going to economies where that potential exists. They don't come when those jobs aren't available. And obviously, when many Americans are out of work, they think of these, of any illegal immigrant, but as you point out, particularly Mexicans who form the largest portion of illegal immigrants in the U.S., as taking away those jobs from Americans.
Roderick A.I. Camp, we're going to need to jump in here. We're out of time. The new book by Roderick A.I. Camp is called Mexico, What Everyone Needs to Know. Roderick, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for all of your very careful questions.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.